think it's a smaller room yet.
Okay, so I welcome back to the second part of the lecture on model-based security engineering. After the more basic stuff yesterday, today I would like to start out with some general results, which I already mentioned yesterday, for questions such as whether refinement or composability preserves security properties under which assumptions. And then I would like to continue with a couple of more advanced topics with respect to connecting model-based assurance to the code level, and also something on runtime verification and on software evolution. And if I have some time, maybe finish up with some applications. So first, the general results, as I said yesterday, having such an approach together with a formal basis, we can now ask general questions which often come up in the context of software development and which are in particular relevant if you worry about critical software. Then the point is that, of course, today's software is very complex and the software processes are also very complex. I tried to point that out yesterday as well. And the usual strategy to try to manage that complexity is divide and conquer. And you can apply that strategy in many directions. So you can apply it on the architectural level in several directions as well. So you can do horizontal and vertical layering of architectures. So horizontal layering might be something like composing the software out of components, or of course in general you might even have a distributed system which is composed out of different nodes in the architecture anyway. And then as well vertical layering, meaning that you might have different services or protocols in a stack running on top of each other. That's another strategy or another application of the strategy of divide and conquer, of course. And then, of course, there are more modern or advanced techniques for trying to manage this complexity. One example is service-oriented software architectures. There, in a sense, it's a special kind of components, but they are now called services, but it's also just another way of partitioning the function of the overall software system into parts. And then even more advanced aspect-oriented architectures where you try to partition the software in a different dimension, in the sense that you divide it up into different aspects which are supposed to be implemented, and then you weave those aspects together. But yet, this is again just another application of this general idea of divide and conquer. And of course, that's a very useful strategy. Otherwise, you won't be able to manage all this complexity. However, if you worry about security or other requirements for that matter, then of course the question is always, if I use this approach, divide and conquer. So I divide the system, I develop the different parts in the system in whichever dimension, horizontal, vertical, or whatever partitioning. And of course, why I do that, I should already worry about the requirements I want to achieve, like security requirements. But then the big question is, if I have done that, and finally I put together those components, so does the final system still satisfy the requirements that I started out with? In our case, again, security requirements, but of course it's a more general question. So ideally, of course, in the end, you have to apply some kind of composition mechanism which composes together your different parts. And ideally, of course, this composition mechanism would preserve your desired requirements, such as security. Unfortunately, that's not the case in general, for various reasons. A very simple reason that it cannot always work is that all the different components that you put together, they might each in themselves implement requirements which are just logically contradictory. So if you have, in terms of security, for example, if you have the vertical layering of services and one of those implements anonymity, but you also, another one implements non-reputability, then these are two properties which simply cannot be achieved at the same time. So if you put these together, then something must break, obviously. So and what breaks depends, of course, on the composition mechanism. So that's a simple example why this cannot simply work in general, and therefore it's an interesting question when it does work. So obviously, in some cases, it will work. Also, ideally, it would be good to know in advance whether it will work. Whenever you do partitioning, before you actually start to implement the components, you already want to know whether this is a good partitioning, because otherwise you spend a lot of time in implementing the components, and in the end you realize when you put it together that it's not going to work. So that would be a lot of wasted time and effort. So ideally you want to know that in advance before you actually start coding. And basically that's the motivation for this part of work, security prioritization with respect to architectural principles, but also divide and conquer is used not only to the software itself, but also to the software development process, because that is also very complex and you also need to manage that as well. And so there's of course one very classical technique that of refinement. Whenever you use specifications to start out with and then start with the coding later, and of course this is older than the idea of model-based development, it has been used in four methods in general for a long time. And the idea is that firstly you use out with rather more abstract specifications, because you can specify your system before actually having to commit to details. And then later you want to have more detailed specifications before you actually start coding, because having the detailed specifications already helps you settling some problems which you will run into when you actually start the coding. So it's good to do a stepwise refinement of those specifications. And there again, the question is, if I start out with one specification and I show that this preserves my desired security properties, which, as I said yesterday, I should do as early as possible, because there are studies by, for example, Barry Byrne from the 60s already, who showed that it is about 100 times as expensive to fix bugs in later phases of the software development cycle than to do it during the requirements phase. So you should do it, you should check your requirements as early as possible. But then the same question comes up. If I prove that my early abstract specification satisfies my security properties, but then I refine it to a more detailed specification and then later to the code, does this refined specification and later the code still preserves the security properties? And unfortunately, in general, the question is again that it's not always guaranteed that this is the case. And of course, this is rather unfortunate, because if you don't have that guarantee, then you have to verify again and again after each refinement step, and then of course again on the code level. And that multiplies the verification efforts until it becomes really unmanageable. So that's why that's also an important question, which, as I said, unfortunately is not always answered to the positive, but I will go into a bit more detail. And in a similar way, refactoring of architectures, so that is something which is somehow between the architectural principles and the development techniques, but it's more as part of the software development. Refactoring means that during the software development and re-engineering, you suddenly realize that it would be useful to change the architecture of your software, because maybe it became unmanageable throughout its history. Then you want to refactor it, and again the question is whether after the refactoring the software will still preserve security. So we have looked at these different scenarios and tried to come up with preconditions under which certain security properties are indeed preserved, and I would like to talk a little bit about some of these results now. So, firstly, refinement, which is the somehow classical of these problems, classical in the sense that this has been looked into for many years now, a couple of years ago there was in fact the observation by Bill Roskow that there is some kind of refinement paradox in the context of their approach using CSP, where refinement, so CSP is a process algebra, you may know that, developed mainly in Oxford, and this process algebra has refinement as a central operator in its notation, so refinement plays quite a big role. So of course it's then an obvious question to think about what this means for security. And they investigated that question quite a number of years ago already in the context of secure information flow verification. And unfortunately in that context, at least initially, they observed that, the approach that they were working with, refinement did not in general preserve security properties. So that's the so-called refinement paradox, as I said already a couple of years ago. As a reaction to that, we also looked at this problem as part of the formal methods approach that we're using as a foundation for the model-based security engineering approach, which I shortly sketched yesterday, and in fact managed to solve this problem as part of our formal approach. The central observation there was that the problem of refinement paradox really comes down to the fact that you are actually talking about different kinds of non-determinism here. So actually several times, non-determinism intuitively of course means that something is not deterministic, which means you don't know in advance what exactly is, so there may be different choices, and you don't know in advance exactly which choices will be taken by the system. So that's a broad definition of non-determinism, and that seems rather obvious and clear, but if you look at it closer, then the question is, okay, when is this non-determinism exactly solved? When do you come to a determinism, and there can be very many different points in time during the system life cycle when that is the case, and that makes a big difference. So, for example, people use non-determinism as a kind of under-specification during the specification phase before the system is actually implemented and running. And the goal for that is under-specification, meaning, when you start with the abstract specifications, you're not yet sure which of the different implementation options you want to choose in the end, so you want to leave that open, and therefore you do under-specification. This is some kind of non-determinism, but not at runtime, but at specification time. And the intention is that this will be settled and before you actually come to implement the system. And therefore, in a sense, it's safe to refine this non-determinism away, or secure to that effect, because this non-determinism is not important for the security of the system. So therefore it should be possible to refine a specification, and you should be able to expect that afterwards you still have your desired security properties. However, there's other kind of non-optimism, namely that non-optimism which should actually be present at runtime and which is important for security. An example for that is of course the generation of random numbers, that is also a non-optimistic process, the generation of keys, etc. So, and this of course you don't want to refine away because, well, you decrease your security if you do that. Now, if you choose in your formal methods to somehow map these two different kinds of non-optimism to the same formal representation, then of course you have a problem because you cannot distinguish these two kinds of non-optimism anymore, and therefore if you apply refinements, not only you reduce under-specification, but also you reduce your security, and that's of course a bad thing, and this is basically what led to the refining problem. So, the solution to that, of course, could be quite simple. You just have to separate these two kinds of non-optimisms to make sure that you only reduce the one kind and not the other one. And basically, on the high level, this is what we've been doing. So, it wasn't actually that difficult in the end to come to a solution there. I will actually come back to a later slide, which points out a bit more technical details for that. But firstly, a couple of more overview slides about these results. So, yes, whenever you like, yes, maybe now. Yes. Yes, so I think we're actually in complete agreement there. You said refinement should of course preserve the requirements that I care about, and I completely agree with that. Now, obviously, when the refinement paradox came up, in that case, that wasn't the case. So, we agree that this is exactly the problem, and what I said now about the different two kinds of non-optimism, this is sort of on a more concrete level than the statement that refinement should preserve the desired properties. This is of course still true, I completely agree with that. I was just trying to find out how could that happen that they use a refinement operator which would not preserve one of their desired properties. And this is why I think that happened. PSP has one refinement operator, and well, I think, so this is here, CSP expert, even though even in within CSP, there's a distinction between internal and external non-optimism. So you have that already, but not, then you have a third kind, which is the under-specification. And so nevertheless, even though this treatment of non-optimism is already quite sophisticated in CSP, there was some mixture which I think led to that refinement paradox. Yes, yeah, so it's not a problem specifically of PSP effect.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Of course, yeah, you know, you have to think about systems on different levels of abstraction. And if I say random generation is a non-deterministic process, then this is true on a medium level of abstraction. So if medium meaning I'm now more concrete than if I have a very, very abstract communication, because I already realized that a random number has to be generated. But, of course, if I even go down further, then eventually I realize that the computer systems we use today are deterministic. Unless you have some quantum mechanical components running in your hardware, which you usually don't, you have a deterministic computer. So therefore, you could say at runtime, with today's PCs, you will never have non-deterministic, because it's a computer, it's a finite state machine, it's a it has a large state space, but it's still finite, so you can you start out with a particular state and you apply deterministic algorithms. So theoretically you could always compute everything in advance, like in chess, same situation. Except that in both situations it's a very complex thing, so usually you don't have the computing power to completely compute all possibilities in a chess game, for example. And, but nevertheless, chess is looking if you apply the optimal strategies on both sides, you could also think it's a deterministic game, even though it looks rather non-deterministic from a higher level. But yeah, I think we actually also perfectly remember that one. So sorry that I'm not in the mood largely, I guess. But you're completely right that this statement is not completely precise. You have to always formulate this relative to your level of abstraction. So depending on where you are on this abstraction hierarchy, it depends on whether this could be seen as non-determinism, or you should already realize that it's really a hidden determinism which you expected away from. But yeah, okay, let's see.
Okay,
yes, yeah. I'm sure, yes. Okay, yes. But then also modularization, and yeah, as I said, this are just going to start with some overview slides. I will come back to a bit more technical details in a couple of slides. So there you have the same problem that in general you might have different components in your software architecture, and ideally you would like to be able to establish for the components separately that they satisfy your desired security properties, and after you've done that you just put them together and you're done, because your composition mechanism is verified to preserve security. Unfortunately, that doesn't work in general. So there, you could also rather easily think of examples. So, for example, if you have two components, one of them sends out a secret on the network, encrypted under a particular key. So, and as long as that key is not published, you would think, yes, that's a secure thing to do. The other component doesn't do anything, but it just happens to send out a key on the network. But it doesn't have any secrets, it doesn't do anything else, and so you could also think, well, if I don't consider that secret, that key to be the secret, then this might also be a secure thing in itself. But of course, if you put these two components together and you can use the one key to encrypt the first message, then of course the result will be something which should be seen as insecure. So, of course, again, that's a trivial example, which just says that maybe similar to the discussion just now, even also in the context of composition, security is always a relative property, it's always relative to the environment of that component that you're currently looking at, and you can never say, or almost never say, that a component is secure in all environments, but you usually can only say that it's secure when you place certain assumptions on the environment of that component. So that's basically also already the solution to that composition or modularity problem. And one way, one strategy of pursuing this solution would be the rely guarantee approach, which of course is also quite a long-standing approach in formal software engineering, which is also predates model-based development quite a long time and is also used outside security, of course. And it means simply that whenever you try to establish properties about components, you formulate these properties in a rely guarantee way, meaning that, of course you still want guarantees about a given component, but they are formulated in a way that they depend on preconditions or on things that the component relies on in the environment, and that is formulated in that relative way. So it's also maybe quite an intuitive approach as well. And so the key idea is that this is one strategy which you can follow in order to address this modularity problem in security as well. So, and I will also come back to later slide with a bit more technical details about how we did this in the outcome. But again, now, in order to answer those questions or even to formulate these kind of questions precisely, again, you need, of course, some kind of formal foundation. Yesterday I mentioned a couple of times a formal semantics which we defined for a fragment of DML to support our approach. What I will use now is in fact a simplified version of that, because the questions which I mentioned in the previous slide are of course of interest also outside model-based development with UML, but they're of interest quite generally. Therefore it makes sense to formulate and answer those questions in a, on a formal basis which is not specifically targeted to this particular software engineering approach. And we've done that in a paper which came out in a journal a couple of years ago, I will shortly introduce this formal foundation. Basically it's quite similar to what I already talked about yesterday. So again, if you again consider the application case of crypto protocols, because as I said yesterday, they're a very nice target for verification because they're compact parts of the system and nevertheless highly non-trivial. So again, you will then have to consider cryptographic operations, and we do it in the same way as yesterday by viewing that as symbolic functions. Basically the only thing I think that's different here is now we need we define some explicit representation for receiving input for a given component over a communication channel, and I think otherwise this is really the same as what we did yesterday. Of course, we could also specify that as part of the UML specification. In fact, several of the UML diagrams support this information, but now we want to really just capture on this as a very abstract concept. So we basically restrict ourselves to this now and don't worry about how this is represented in the UML. But we, of course, again, we don't only need these cryptographic terms, but we also need some ways not only to communicate, but also to specify branching behavior of the system. And this is something which, according to UML, you would write as a state chart, but because now we would like to reason about properties of these specifications, it's sometimes more convenient to use a textual notation for the specification. So here we now define a very simple notation which allows us basically to express the kind of branching behavior which we have in state chart as part of this executable specification notation. And then of course we also need some kind of communication system model. So the idea is now that because we specifically want to consider modularity, the system is composed of different components, each of which has different input channels and output channels, and we can also connect output channels to the input channels, which means that they are local channels that you can send feedback on. And the central idea, in fact, relies on an approach called Focus, developed by Broil and Sterling. There's a book in 2001 which basically spells this out, and our approach to apply for this security is based on that general idea. So you have different kinds of communication channels, and then you can use this notation to define the behavior of a given component which communicates over those communication channels. Of course, it's always a useful thing to be able to reason about the specifications in different representations. And one strategy is to derive from these executable specifications, derive functions which map input values to output values, because in some situations you can reason about functions, mathematical functions, easier than you could about reason about the original textual specifications. So what we define here is in fact a mapping of those expressions in this textual notation to functions from input values to output values. So as I pointed out on the previous slide, and you have to view each component as a function which receives a sequence of input values and sends out a sequence of output values. And for each of the elements in the notation, we define how this function is iteratively defined, starting out with the original terms. So for each term, you can just say that this term defines itself as an output value, and then for each of the branching statements, the branching behavior is translated to the behavior at the part of the input-output functions. So for example, here you now in fact have this non-dimension, which is translated to the union of possible output values at the side of the outputs of the function. So that also means, in particular, we now model on the mathematical level, we model non-dimension on the output side by sets of possible output values, meaning that any element in the output sets can be output by the component at a given point in time. And because if there are several such elements in the set, then we can easily have some unity. And again, so you can now also for this form of foundation, you can define the same kind of security analysis which we've done yesterday on the basis of the UML notation. So this is just pretty much repeating what I defined yesterday, but now starting out with this formal specification notation. Again, this is basically what we see yesterday. If I have an expression, that simply means that the attacker gets that expression, and if there are some subterms in the expression that are needed to construct the expression, then the attacker first needs to know those subterms in order to give them to the component that is supposed to construct that expression and send it out to the network. So this is basically a bit more precise version of what we've seen yesterday, and yesterday's version was also precise, but not as precisely on the screen that that I showed you. And again, if you have non-dimension, this basically means that on the logical level, you have a set of formula which are basically put together by conjunctions, meaning that basically intuitively the attacker can use the axioms to try to derive the statement knows of S, if again we are worrying that there's a secret S that should get secret. So if we have non-dimension, that means that the attacker should be able to use, we want to make a safe approximation, then that means that the attacker might be able to use this statement and might also be able to use that statement. Of because usually they might not be able to use both at the same time. So this is already an approximation that we do here, but it's a safe approximation. So then we don't worry about whether this is the case or that is the case. We simply say we give all of both options to the attacker, and this makes the attacker stronger than they necessarily have to be, but it's a safe approximation. So whatever attack exists, we will find that way. We might also get some false positives that way, but that is usually a trade-off in this kind of approach. And similarly for the other constructs in that notation, with an if-and-else statement, this is also basically translated to a logical representation of what happens when you execute such a statement. Case construct is similar to if-and-else, and yeah, this is basically what's on the slide. And again, you could have a look at the example from yesterday. So the first step would now be to take the sequence diagram and express it as a part of, or using this textual specification notation which I just defined. Now it looks a bit more complicated. Depending on your point of view, it's now more readable or less readable than the previous slide. So depending on whether you have a problematic background, you would probably say, oh, this is much better than the sequence diagram. And if you're a practical software developer, you would probably say, I prefer the sequence diagram. But maybe not. So I'm actually undogmatic about this, but there are people with very strong views on it, so it's a very interesting discussion. Anyway, so yeah, one way would be to express the this component now using this textual notation, and that way it looks now this like this, and this would contain exactly the same information as the sequence diagram that you've seen on the previous slide. And again, using the this translation to first-order logic, which I explained on the last slide before, this will again give us the same kind of logical representation which we've already seen briefly yesterday. And of course, again, you can derive nodes of S from this example because of that problem. Now, basically now we can come back to this promised statement about refinement. So firstly, we have now briefly defined the formal foundation, which even allows us to formulate the problem precisely. We can now say what it means for a component to refine another component. We do this here referring to those functions which I defined earlier, so I just jump back. So if you remember, here we define this specification notation, and here I define for each component a function from input values or sequences of input values to sets of sequences of output values on the basis of that notation. And because, as I already pointed out here, we have sets of sequences of output values, we can now define refinement, which basically means that we decrease those sets of possible sequences of output values. That is now our notion of refinement, because those sets represent the non-continuity which is still present in the specific solution. So if we decrease the sets, we have less non-continuity, and therefore that's our refinement. And that's in fact also the reason why I define this mapping to the function level in the first place, because it allows us to formulate this notion of refinement in a rather intuitive way. Because we can also define it directly on the syntactic level, but then you have to do it inductively on the syntactic elements, and it doesn't look quite as pretty. Obviously the most trivial example is this one, so the statement either P or Q can be refined to the statement P or to the statement Q, of course. So that's a sort of generic example for refinement. And then in fact, on the basis of this formal foundation, we could then prove this theorem, which I only state here, that first, this is what you would expect if key preserved to CFM and he defines the key, then key also preserved to CFM, where this again is defined in relation to this translation to further logic, which I explained. And here we have a variation on that, which already goes in the direction of this VLI guarantee approach, which I mentioned earlier. So I will say a little bit about, more about that in a couple of slides, but because we already have it here, I will just briefly say how it is to be interpreted. So in this VLI guarantee way, we define a variation of this secrecy preservation requirement, namely E preserves secrecy of M assuming C. And this is now a sort of RELI guarantee statement where this part is the RELI part and this part is then the guarantee part. So as long as P can rely on C being true and C can be for us for now is just a logical statement, as long as the logical statement C is true, P guarantees that it will preserve the secrecy of M. And of course now you can then use C to formulate assumptions about the environment of that component P. For example, that the environment will not publish keys that are necessary to preserve the secrecy of M because P send out M encrypted under the particular key, for example. Coming back to that simple example which I mentioned earlier. So as I said, I will come back to this shortly, but this is already mentioned here. So on this refinement slide, I just want to say that once you define those RELI guarantee way of certification, you can, this is still preserved by the refinement operator. So of course, it would be nice to have different ways of reasoning that they also are coherent with each other, and this is in fact the case. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, in this simple example, that is in fact true. So I will come back to this issue about liveness properties later in, when I talk about runtime verification. So we can discuss that then in a bit more detail. But here, in fact, yes, so that is very much true. So you could also say, we now, so as I said earlier, one should make sure that different kinds of molecules are separated, the one that you need and the one that you don't need for security. So the way this is done here is done in a rather simple way, in fact. So the non-prism necessary for security is now completely encapsulated in these symbols here, like the encryption operators, the unguessable values, which are in fact at implementation time implemented as random number generation, and so this is how we did this, follow the strategy of separating these two kinds of non-prism. So the security non-prism is now contained in these symbols, and the non-prism by underspecification is now contained in this operator. So we have a clear separation. And this is now not intended to be used for non-prism, which should still be present at runtime. So we simply say, don't do that. And because we say that, we can now safely refine this way. And as you say, it's not magic. It's just a clean way of separating things and not mixing them. But basically, yes, that's the idea, which is not, I think this is rather important.
Yeah.
Which, sorry, you found
it? You have to bring the music card to add to the
okay, okay. Yes, so this is what I would, yeah, you could also call it refinement. This is what I would probably call refactoring, so I will come back to that in a couple of slides, where you substitute one component by something which contains more detail. But okay, yeah, but in fact you have to be careful about what you mean by this notion precisely. And refinement for me now here is simply this issue of producing non-generalism at specification. But again, I think for time reasons I will skip some of the technical details. And then, in fact, we are already at this slide. So yeah, I think the comment is very true that what I just said about refinement is a particular kind of refinement, and there are other ways and other kinds. In fact, if you look at the literature, there's also something called action refinement, also in the context of process algebras, where people say, well, as part of an abstract specification, in a process algebra specification, I might have a particular action. But then if I want to come down to a more concrete specification, I want to substitute that abstract action by something more concrete and do refinement that way. Which maybe is a bit more what you meant. And this is, I think, similar to what we are trying to do here. Again, in the context of this particular formal approach, where, well, intuitively, you start out with that component P1 on top, and you want to substitute that by something more complex, namely, firstly, a component P2, but also two wrappers around that component, D and U, which are separate components themselves. And well, you might call that, yeah, in fact, you can call that refinement if this is something that you do at specification time in order to arrive from an abstract specification to a more concrete specification. But it's also something that you sometimes do when you are, after you already implemented the system, when you already have a system, when you want to refactor the architecture. For some reason, you start out with a component P1 and you want to change it to a component P2. But in order to be able to do that, you might need some additional components in order to, for example, wrap the component P2 into these components to get the same behavior maybe that P1 delivered in the first place. So this is a typical situation that you have, and as I said, you might have this at specification time, but you could also have it with legacy systems where at some point you decide that you want to change the system architecture. And there raised the same question now under, so which conditions do I have to pose at this new component P2 so that, and also the additional components B and U, such that the result will in fact preserve or satisfy the security properties that the first component provided in the first place. So here we also looked a bit in depth into that question in the context of our formal foundation, in the context of the kind of analysis that I explained earlier. And I don't have so much time to go into too much detail about this now, but basically, here we have one example for a result which explains that under certain assumptions about the new components VU and P2, it is in fact the case that for example, a security property such as secrecy will be preserved by this refactoring process. And again, of course, the same comment applies that this statement applies a particular security property, which again was defined in with reference to this WFAO specification approach, which I mentioned yesterday. Of course, again, it doesn't mean that this question is now settled for all security properties that you want to think about and for all ways of formalizing security properties, but this is still considering this particular way of verifying secrecy properties based on the WFAO approach, which I mentioned. But it's it's an example for such a result that we have tried to come up with. And before the break, maybe I try to finish this section shortly. So you can do lots of variations on these kinds of changes on the specification level. For example, change up to a set of behaviors. So the problem is that if you refactor specifications in practice, usually it is not guaranteed that the behavior is preserved. Because, well, there is a strong reason that the system should be refactored, and this will usually lead to a situation where a part of the behavior of the system will indeed change. And it may in fact be the motivation to do the refactoring, either because the functional behavior should change, or maybe because the performance should be improved, which of course is a good thing, but it's also a change of the behavior, because performance is part, is an aspect of the system behavior, and if you improve the performance, then obviously that will change the behavior of the system, even though it's a good thing, but it will change the behavior, which means that a priori it's also not clear whether this then preserves your other properties that you're worried about, such as security, because, well, if the behavior changes, you a priori you don't know what else might change and whether something might go wrong. So, it is, in fact, but it's not present, it's not the first citizen, it's not the first order citizen on this syntax level. However, of course, there is an underlying execution semantics for that syntax, and on the level of that execution semantics, well, you could, in fact, you have time ticks. So if you have, I didn't talk too much about these mathematical functions, but I said, well, they are functions from input values to output values. Functions from sequences of input values to sets of sequences of output values, and then the question is, what is a sequence? Of course, you can then decide whether you view a sequence as untimed, it's just a an ordered sequence, or you can say it's a timed sequence, which then means that it really has a significance where in that sequence your value is, and you might also have empty slots in that sequence because nothing happens at that point in time. So therefore you can in fact think about time, and therefore you also can think about performance. I'm not necessarily recommending to use this approach to that, and of course there are many specialized approaches for reasoning about performance. However, it's all in there, right? I mean, basically I didn't really want to talk about performance here anyway. It was just an example that if you do refactoring, then usually some part of the behavior will change, even though, of course, from a verification point of view, it would be great if you could do refactoring without changing the behavior, because then you would be done. You would just say, okay, the behavior wasn't changed by the refactoring, therefore it's still the same, therefore it still satisfies the same properties that it satisfied in the first place. However, that's unfortunately not realistic, sometimes for reasons which are very obvious. If you want to improve performance, for example, that will change behavior in a certain way, and you cannot a priori exclude that it also changes the behavior in other ways. Anyway, I already mentioned at the previous slide, which also hinted at this assumption specification earlier. I already mentioned that, but just for clarity, I would just want to explain it again here. So one of these challenges that we looked into was, as I said, this issue of modularity, and our strategy for addressing that was, as I said, this rely guarantee approach, which again just means that you formulate your requirements at a given component with respect to assumptions on the environment of that component. And that is in fact the classical rely guarantee approach, sometimes also called assume guarantee approach. And this is now the definition of that expression which I already used and formally defined earlier. So as I said, we would like to be able to formulate a certain security property, for example, in, again, this secrecy property, which I defined more formally earlier. We would like to formulate this with respect to an assumption, and this assumption here is now formulated as a relation between output and input streams. Basically, this is now a set of possible behaviors of the environment of the component P that I'm looking at. Now, the relation now goes basically from the output streams of the output values of P to the input values of P because, well, basically coming back to this earlier picture, if we have a component P, then from the point of view of the environment of that component, the environment gets the output values of P as input values, and it provides its own output values as input to P. So that's basically the mirror image to P. So therefore, the set of possible environments of P is then, can then be specified by referring to the relations between the sequences of output values of P, and these sequences are called strings, just to have a shorter way of talking about it, to the input streams of P, because these are exactly the output streams of the environment of P. Because we are worried about security properties, we also have to take into account this attacker model. We say that by formulating this rely guarantee statement, we have to make this relative to the possible attackers, which are now present in this environment of the component P. So this is, as I said, this is basically C is a bound on the possible environment behaviors, and we have to make sure that within that bound there is no attacker behavior in that set which manages to break the security property that we're worried about here. So the goal of formulating this definition this way is in fact to avoid the problem which I mentioned earlier, that you have two components, one of which encrypts the secret under a key, sends it out to the network, doesn't do anything else, and the other one publishes the key. So we have to, when we look at this, the first component, and we want to consider what are the admissible behaviors of the environment of that component, we have to exclude the behavior of another component which does something like that, which publishes the key which is supposed to stay secret in order to protect the secret that we started out with. So that's why this rely guarantee definition is now more complicated than you usually have it when you don't worry about security, because we now explicitly refer to this attacker in that context. Here we have an example which in fact works in a similar way to the example which I gave earlier, except that it's an if-then-else construct which is Basically, if it receives a certain password, then it sends back the secret, but in principle it's the same idea of encrypting the secret under a cryptographic key. I think now I'm actually at the break. So this is probably best if I continue with that after the break. I want to look at a simple example which points out how to use these techniques of modularity and refinement as part of a simple application scenario, and wrap up the section with this example, and then continue with a couple of more advanced assurance techniques such as runtime verification, and also talk a little bit about evolution for the rest of today. Are there any more questions for now? Otherwise, I would suggest we make a 5-minute break and continue at 10 after 10. Yes, hello, 1, 2. I actually think it's desirable to have an interaction between the lecturer and the audience rather just a broadcast. And I think that's actually good. I'm sure there are lots of points which are not clear while I talk, so I'm always grateful for people to point out some of those points which are not clear. So I'm happy the opportunity to make them, try to make them clear. Ganz gut. und selber
auch gibt es heute noch oder morgen?
Heute. Ich müsste gleich relativ schnell auf los. Wollen wir jetzt kurz draufschauen?
Nein, es geht nicht draufschauen, sondern es geht gerade so um das Radar. Ich habe gerade gemerkt,
oder so, genau,
ja. Dortmundern abgeklärt, wie das aussieht. Und es sieht nicht mit was verschieden aus.
Okay. Ja, also die Konferenz können wir auch nicht verschieben.
Ich denke, das ist ein geringeres Übel, wenn einer nicht da ist, weil der Effekt von verschieben wäre, dass wahrscheinlich die Externen nicht mehr können.
Ach so, ja.
So weiter.
Da ist ja auch nicht gedacht.
Ja, und das ist das Übel, dass einer nicht da ist, geringer als das Übel, den wir durch Verschieben aufmachen.
Ja. Ja, da müsste man, ich sag mal so, da müsste man halt eine neue Terminrunde eröffnen und das würde die Sache zumindest um vermutlich ein paar Monate
genau,
verschieben.
Genau, dann sind wir eigentlich schon wieder bei der Frühjahrsklausurtagung.
Ja.
Und von daher ist zumindest jetzt auch in Dortmund KD und die haben auch nochmal nachgehört, das ist schon festgebucht, der Termin, wenn wir
dagegen
haben, wir kosten auch nochmal drauf und da scheint es einfach einfacher zu sein, nicht zu verlegen, wenn das eine nicht da ist. Wenn wir verlegen, müssen wir davon ausgehen, dass zwei nicht da sind zum Gehen jetzt. Vor allem Leute, die sie selten liest, was auch wichtiger ist, weil ich kann meine Sache im Notfall auch mal im Oberseminar machen.
Mhm. Okay. Mhm. Ja, da hatten wir jetzt irgendwie nicht aufgepasst mit dem Termin, aber gut.
Ja, keine Konferenz immer gleich beim Termin.
Ja, ja, genau. ja, ich bin auch immer eher nicht pessimistisch, aber ich sag erstmal, schauen wir mal hin.
Genau. Dann würde ich jetzt kommunizieren, dass ich immer im Wochenende meinen Tag übernehme und dann verschieben wir es nicht.
Okay, ja.
Ja?
Mhm.
is actually on that. If you look at the fine semantic top sequences, the final paradox pops up again in time intents.
Yeah.
Got a micro system where a particular output is delivered at any moment, and a system which delivers the output at a specific moment.
Yes.
Leaking information again.
Yes, yeah. So,
time and determinism may again pop up.
So I guess what I presented on that slide was still at a rather high level of abstraction, and the deeper you go, the more information you get into, and you still want to be responsible learning, the harder you have to work. So I'm in no way saying that this already is the final answer to everything.
No.
Basically, the first step in the direction. It's already also a couple of years ago, so the paper from 2001 basically. I haven't had the time to look into that.
But it's no wonder, for example, what you're doing by encoding the classification of jungles in the monsters and the trees and things like that is exactly what the CSP is doing.
Yeah.
They want the whole Casper FBI approach.
Yes.
It doesn't actually have the FBI in this crazy time. Exactly what that
is. Yeah. Yes. Okay, so let's continue with the last part of this lecture, and I just want to finish up the bit I talked about before the break. So I introduced a couple of results regarding preservation of security properties by various kinds of techniques like refinement and modularity, and just want to finish off with a small example. Assuming you have a rather abstract specification of a channel between a client and a server, of course, well, this is already one step further. You could start off by just having two boxes, C and S, and arrows between them. But of course, we now want to worry about how this confidential channel will actually be implemented. And as usual, this is done by making use of a cryptic protocol. So we already say, okay, this channel is something of interest to us. We want to look at it more closely. The first step one could do would be, for example, to use a cryptic protocol such as the one that we looked at, which unfortunately had a vulnerability, but just to stick with that example, we will consider that here as well. So what you would do is then, after starting out with this abstract architecture, you refine this to the situation where you still have the client and the server. Now, instead of this box which represents the communication channel, you have also the client and server side of that protocol, but then you now take into account the attacker, which might sit on the web network and is in principle in complete control of the communication between those parts of the protocol. And in particular, you could then consider one side of these two sides of the protocol. And so the goal is now to find a client-side protocol which will in fact support this security property that we want to have for our original communication channel. And one way of carrying through the stepwise refinement is to firstly say very abstractly what is the maximally possible behavior that this client side part of the protocol would be able to perform. So it's with the non-deterministic sum of all the outputs that are needed for the handshake part of the protocol, and then the goal is to preserve that, to show that this maximally non-deterministic specification, this maximally under-specified specification of your client side of the protocol already preserves the secrecy of the message that is going to be sent out, and then as a next step, you can actually break this non-deterministic sum into more concrete parts, which are then actually the implementation of the actual protocol. And you can, in fact, by making use of this conditional interface refinement, which is a particular kind of refinement that we considered, you can actually break this down to the actual client side of the protocol. So that was basically the overview just showing the architecture of that picture and how it's broken down. And if you go to the details, then the way this would look like is the originally maximally underspecified version looks very simple, like this, where you just specify the messages that are supposed to be sent out at all in some order and under some conditions. This is these are the components that are defined down here on the slides. And then at the next step, you provide the details which are actually necessary to implement the protocol which was specified. And this is seen down here on that slide. Together with the specification which you can see here. And then you can, for the fixed version of this protocol, which indeed does preserve the secrecy of the communicated message, you can then show that this is a refinement of that earlier non-deterministic sum in a way that this refinement in fact preserves that secrecy property. So this is one way you could also prove the security of the fixed version of that TLS variant by performing this kind of stepwise refinement approach. This is an alternative, of course, to just use the automated tools which I mentioned yesterday, which do the verification automatically. You wouldn't necessarily do it that way, but this is just what I showed here in order to demonstrate how this kind of approach would work. But it usually comes up in a situation where, for example, you have an architectural refactoring and therefore you need to proceed that way. Okay, this was just to wrap up that section. Now, yesterday and this morning so far, I mostly talked about the model level, which may not be surprising because the lecture is called Model-Based Security Engineering. However, as I also pointed out in the beginning yesterday, of course, the final goal is not just to have a secure model, which is a nice thing to have, but well, there's only so much you can do with it, but you want to have a secure system in the end. So unfortunately, you have to do more for that. Because Well, I mean, theoretically, of course, having your secure model, you would only have to press a button on your code generator, which was formally verified and preserves all the security properties that you have on your model, and you're done. So if that would be the case today, I could finish the lecture now and we could go to lunch early or something. Unfortunately, it's not the case, so I have to keep talking for a bit because this magic code generator doesn't exist yet. Even though, of course, in a sense, it's a long-term goal as part of the UML community to have such code generators so that in the future, as much as possible, you only have to create UML models. But while it exists to some degree, and in some application domains, it's rather far-reaching. For example, in embedded systems, you can actually work that way. But in general, software architectures usually still have to do some manual coding. And then you have that challenge of also making sure that the code is secure, not just the model. And this is what in the remaining time, I will try to look into now a little bit. This is a bit more about motivation. Some of that I touched yesterday already. You might say, well, if I have to worry about the security of the code, why do I even worry about the security of the model? I could just model around, implement everything, and then start worrying about security. Unfortunately, that is an approach which is often taken in practice, but it's not the most efficient one because, as I already mentioned, things become more expensive that way because you will run into problems which you hopefully will notice. If you are unlucky, you won't, but even if you notice them, it will be more expensive to fix them when you already have an implementation than if you would have fixed them earlier. So that's why, even though I'm now going to talk about the code, it still makes sense to already do verification on the model level. But of course, it's also important to look at the code because, unfortunately, so far we don't have that magic code generator which is proven secure and correct and solves our problems. If we had that, yeah, we wouldn't have to do it. So now, of course, there are different strategies you could follow, assuming you work in the context of model-based development. This is basically the first option, which I already mentioned, which would be nice, but doesn't really exist yet, this universal code generator, which is verified, formally proven to preserve security properties. So unfortunately, that's not our option today. Then, of course, you can also go the other way around. You could, if you start out with the code, you could try to extract models from the code and then verify those models. Unfortunately, that is also not possible in general. I mean, there are some tools that do this to some degree, and that's quite interesting, but it doesn't work in general as well. So in the end, in many cases, you still have to, even though you invested the effort in creating models, you still have to do some manual coding independently. Although that's not actually so bad, of course, to some degree, it's additional effort and it's redundant. However, redundancy is a good thing to find mistakes and errors, as long as you have a way to check the consistency between your two redundant artifacts, like the model and the code. And of course, there are various strategies to do that. And in fact, we have a dedicated lecture on model-based testing, so I will not say much about this in my lecture. But there are also alternative other approaches for doing that, which I will now shortly look at. Okay, so basically the goal is to compare the models with the code with a particular view to security and attackers that may be present in that scenario. One option, as I said, would be to generate models from the code. And as I said, there are tools that allow you, for example, to generate control flow graphs, and once you have them, you could of course just apply the same approach which I explained yesterday, which allows you to verify UML state charts. You can also just apply them to control flow graphs, and basically that's one way to go. Unfortunately, even though you have these kind of tools, for large software that is not very well manageable. Because basically what they do is for each line in the code, they create one state in your state machine, and that will be many states if you have a large piece of software. So it doesn't really raise the level of abstraction which you would rather want to have in order to do efficient verification. So therefore, that's, as I said already, this is not what we're doing, but instead we try to create models in the code independently and then try to verify that after verifying the security of the models, the code in fact is consistent with the model, and in particular also preserves the security properties. And we have done a case study on that as in part of Java. So there is part of the Java security library, the Java Secure Socket extension, where you actually have an implementation of the protocol SSL. And alternatively, there's an open source implementation of that called Jesse, which was done because originally JSSE was not open source. By now it is actually, but therefore we still have this alternative implementation Jesse, and we looked at these two implementations and in order to find out how to best do this kind of model code verification. So in the context of a Hippo protocol, what we have to worry about now is to firstly link the relevant bits in your Hippo protocol model to the implementation level, and these are the points where, well, firstly, these are the symbols that are used in the specification, such as random values. You have to identify them on the code level and make sure that they are used correctly, and then also the points where messages are received and messages are sent out, and the points where certain conditions need to be checked in the protocol in order to continue with the protocol. And of course, these are very important, that these are implemented correctly in the correct place for the security of the protocol. And in fact, this is quite a non-trivial thing, and problems happen there. I mean, you might think now, well, you just have to make sure that you implement this model correctly, and you don't have to worry much about that, as long as you don't do any mistakes. But, well, mistakes happen, and sometimes very surprising ones. One example for that was one recent version of OpenSSL, where suddenly someone found a bug, which was rather surprising. So of course there are various signature checks in that implementations, and signature checks are of course done by calling a function in the case in C, because OpenSSL is implemented in C, and that function will perform a signature check and will return give a return value on I think 0 or 1, I don't remember exactly what the numbers were. And then, of course, the program continues, but of course it's important to interpret that return value correctly and not the wrong way around. I mean, of course, yeah, it should not be surprising that you you should try to avoid mixing the 0 and the 1. Unfortunately, this is exactly what happened here. So the function which implemented the signature check did not follow the convention which you usually do in C programming when giving back return values. But it did it the other way around, and the person who implemented the protocol and who used that function wasn't aware of the fact, so things broke there, because well, basically the result of that function call was ignored, which obviously makes the protocol completely insecure. So, and they realized that after a couple of years, I think. So this was a recent bug in OpenSSL. Yeah, it is quite important that these bits are in fact implemented correctly, and unfortunately mistakes happen there. So what we did there was firstly to try to link the symbols in the specification to the implementation level. This is something which, well, in fact we had to do manually, so unfortunately there's so far no intelligent tool which would be able to understand all of these names and also to follow up what these functions and attributes really are doing in order to make sure that this is really, that they are really implementing the symbols which we have in the specification. So unfortunately, if you are given a legacy implementation, you have to do this mapping manually. If you start out with a model and then implement the implementation from the model, then of course you should know yourself what you're doing, and you should in fact have this mapping in mind while you do the implementation. But in our case, we applied this approach to a legacy implementation, so we had to reverse engineer this mapping. And in fact, of course, we cannot simply rely on the names here, some of which are also not very telling, but we have to make sure that things are really what we think they are. And in order to do that, we really have to follow through all of these function calls until we are finally convinced that, for example, the value which was called random bytes, which sounds like a random number, is in fact a random number which is in fact generated by a method from a Java library which we trust that it will actually securely generate a random number. Of course, at that point, or at some point, we have to stop. Of course, someone could also take on the responsibility to verify that class to make sure that it really is a secure random number generator, but at that point, for our purpose, we stopped and we said, okay, this is the point where we start trusting the community that this is in fact a secure thing. And of course, you had to draw those boundaries, otherwise it would be clearly unmanageable. So the next thing, after identifying the symbols on the implementation level, we have to find the points where the messages are sent out and received in our sequence diagram. This is fortunately relatively easy because in Java and also in other languages, you usually use message buffers to send out and receive messages. So you just have to find the points where messages are written to those buffers or received from those buffers, and these were easy enough to check. Although again, this requires some tracking of the relevant method calls. So intuitively enough, there is a method called write, which in fact writes arguments to that buffer. But you still have to track these methods through the relevant classes. This is how Jesse is organized, that you actually have to track this through the various classes which implement the various messages in the protocol, and then the arguments in those messages, and then the parts of those arguments. So that requires some tracking, but then in fact we were able to identify these points, and in the end we still have to identify the points where the constraints are checked. And then we have to make sure that these are in fact checked correctly, not as in the case of OpenSSL, as I just mentioned. And again, you have various options for doing that. You can generate runtime checks, which check at runtime. So basically, you have a monitor running in parallel with your protocol, which makes sure that after this point is reached and before this point is reached, in fact, the implementation correctly performs this check. That is one option, which is simple and effective, but of course you get a performance penalty because you have a monitor running in parallel, which consumes resources. You could also do testing at this point. You have to be a bit careful by testing because, well, for the problems I pointed out yesterday, that exhaustive testing which amount to brute force attack, which is not possible. So you have to replace the cryptographic values basically by symbols, because you cannot afford to insert all possible concrete values that would be possible for the various random numbers and keys. But it's possible. Our third option is to do a static verification of the implementation, to in fact statically verify that between these two points you always go to a point which checks this condition. And yeah, we have in fact looked at all of these three different options. So this is maybe what I still want to point out. So this is basically visualizes the third option, that of this static check, namely, again, at the visualizing this at the end of a basically a control flow graph. What we have to do now statically is to verify that whenever the program goes to the point P in the control flow graph, which corresponds to a certain point in the protocol where a certain message is received, and before the program reaches the next point where the message is sent out to the network, we have to check using static analysis that at each path from P to Q, we go through a point where this condition D is in fact checked, and we only continue if that check is positive. And in the case of the JESS implementation, this check is implemented by calling the method check server trusted. And in fact, it turned out for this concrete example that in fact there is only one path from this point to that point, and it does go to a call of that method. So again, here of course we can either rely on that this check is in fact doing the right thing, or we should at least have a look at what it's doing to avoid problems like an OpenSSL. And in the extreme case, we could also verify that formally, of course, but of course that would be quite a bit more effort at that point. So, I don't have so much time left, so I don't really have the time to give more than this overview about this part of the work, but if you're interested in that, in particular about the static verification, there has actually been, over the last couple of years, joint work with Andy Gordon from Microsoft Research Cambridge and two of our PhD students. And we have a couple of papers on how to do this formal verification, in this case of C implementations of cryptographic protocols, which, yeah, of course, yeah, if you're interested in that kind of work, you might find it interesting to have a look at these papers. But yeah, for time reasons, I can now just briefly have a look at one of the other two alternatives which I pointed out. If you remember, either a static verification of the code or model-based testing, and I'm not going to say anything about that because we have a dedicated lecture on that, and I don't want to interfere with that. But the third option is this runtime check, and this is what I now want to shortly talk about. This is some joint work with Andreas Bauer from National University of Australia, where there's also a paper you might have a look at. If you remember, the question is now generally, if I did all of this assurance at the model level and maybe static assurance on the code level, how do I know that the system is still secure when it's running? Even if I did some testing, while the system will be usually be executed in a different environment. So if you do testing, of course you could try to do testing in a production environment, but usually you do it on a separate environment, and if you really want to be perfectly secure that things don't go wrong when you run the system, you can, an alternative option is to do runtime verification, which basically means that you have a monitor running parallel to the system, which watches the system and makes sure that the critical security requirements are not broken by your software. So if you're really paranoid, you may want to do that. You may also want to do that if for some reason you could not apply these other assurance techniques. So if it's, for example, a legacy software which wasn't developed in a model-based way, then you may not have a specification, you may not have a model, and you may not have access to the source code either. If you don't own the software, you only get the bytecode. And if you only trust the software vendor by a certain degree, then, well, you might want to run the software, but you might want to monitor that it doesn't do too much damage to your system. And that is where you also can use runtime verification, which of course again is a more general approach, which, well, there's actually a whole community which does that. Originally, that was derived from the idea of model checking. So basically, yeah, in model checking, you generate the possible execution sequences of your system, and you consider those execution sequences to make sure that nothing goes wrong in any of them. In runtime verification, you're a bit lazy. You're only looking at the concrete execution sequence which is currently happening while you execute the system. So in a sense, it's lazy model checking. Of course, in a sense, it's a much easier problem than model checking, because you only have to verify a small fragment of the potential behavioral space of the system. But on the other hand, the challenge is to do this as quickly as possible in order to reduce the performance overhead, because you do it in parallel. And the other challenge is to identify potential problems as early as possible, when you still can stop the system before things really go wrong. So, for example, if you have an e-commerce system where maybe a credit card number is transferred over the internet, suddenly the monitor sees that, oops, this credit card number is going to be transferred without being encrypted, and that's not good, then it should of course stop the system before the number is actually sent out to the network, not afterwards. Ideally, so you have to make sure that you stop it at the right point. Of course, if for some reason that doesn't work and you only notice it afterwards, it can still be useful, because you can at least notice that the credit card number might have been eavesdropped. You can cancel the credit card, etc. So it's still useful, but ideally, of course, it should be done as early as possible. And so this is also a motivation for this particular work, that we try to find the earliest possible in the execution of the system where we can already say that things will go wrong from here. But firstly, again, also some formal foundation for this kind of work. Again, a different formal technique which is being used here. Here we use temporal logic because simply this is what usually used in model checking. You can then use an approach for monitor generation, which is basically inspired by translation of LTL to VP automata. For time reasons, I have to skip a little bit here. Basically, the variation which we're using here, which is based on the dissertation of Andreas, is that instead of the usual semantics for LTL, we now use a pre-valued semantics, which is particularly useful for the monitoring purposes, because it allows us to distinguish between the states where we already know that the system fails its expected properties, or where we know that the system will always satisfy its expected properties. And then we have a third state where it's still not clear whether at some point in the future the system may or may not satisfy those properties. And this is particularly useful in the context of this monitoring. Targeted this kind of approach now to the case of monitoring security properties, and in fact also applied it in the context of triple protocol assurance. And again, here we see an example which we've seen earlier, namely this JESSE implementation. Just an example how this works. As I mentioned, the goal is now to check that the various conditions which according to the protocol specifications have to be implemented correctly, that these are actually checked correctly at runtime. And this is done, here you can see this the automaton which is generated for one of these checks, namely the one that comes right before the client sends out the client key exchange message. A certain check has to be performed. And basically that this is in fact the case is this property is represented by this state machine, and from this state machine we can now generate a monitor which actually checks the system, or monitors the system at runtime, that this check, this condition will always be satisfied by the client side of the protocol. And then of course you have to do this for all of the conditions that according to the protocol has to be checked, both at the client and the server side. So you have a monitor which monitors the client side, make sure that it checks, performs all these checks correctly, and the monitor which does that for the server side. And that way you can monitor at runtime that the checks which are specified on the specification are actually carried out correctly. Okay, we'll skip about, maybe just mention this example as well. Earlier we had this comment about safety and liveness properties. In fact, that is indeed also a critical issue in this case here. So of course, security monitoring is also a topic which has been looked at for some time now, and one famous approach for that is the security automata by Fred Schneider. But in that work, he also started out with monitoring safety properties. And in fact, when you look at some applications like at this SSL protocol that we looked at, in some situations, in fact, you would like to be able to express properties which are not safety and also not host safety properties, which could be relatively easy and with a dual construction. The approach which we work out here is in fact able to also deal with other properties which do not fall in either of these classes, and so it in a sense goes beyond what was possible with a security automata before. Okay, and I guess somehow getting to the end of our lecture. So I'm afraid I have to leave out the section about these applications and can only go through this section about evolution relatively quickly. Evolution, which basically I already pointed out at the beginning yesterday, is in fact of course a challenge. Evolution happens all the time with respect to practical software. Things change all the time. As soon as you have requirements, the customer changes their minds and wants to have different requirements. And of course this can also happen later, after you already started modeling or implementing. All things might change, the environment might change, security requirements might change because legislation changes, or you suddenly want to employ the same software in a different environment, or all kinds of things might change for all kinds of reasons. And in each case, on the one hand, of course, you would like to reuse the existing software, the existing artifacts to save the effort to construct everything again from scratch. On the other hand, the question is whether the changes break or preserve security. So this is basically something which we looked at in a European project, the Secure Change project. This is a project which finished earlier this year, and basically there we spent more or less the whole project on this particular problem, namely how to handle software evolution with respect to security critical software, how to determine whether the evolution breaks security, what to do if that is the case, and how to determine that it doesn't, which is of course the good thing where you don't have to do anything further. Basically this is also what I explained here. I think I have to skip to some of these slides for time reasons. We can only point out maybe some of the central results of that project. So this is basically a slide which summarize the whole project, which of course we only work at some part of it. Basically we And non-surprisingly, we mostly focus on the part of the UML modeling approach, we developed a tool which we call the MedSec tool, now it's the Charisma tool, which I already mentioned yesterday, which is not only able to verify the UML models for the security properties in a way which I was able to explain for some examples in this lecture, but on the basis of the result from the project is now also able to do this verification in the situation where evolution takes place, and to do that in an intelligent way. Of course, you want to avoid having to re-verify the complete specification because evolution took place, and we were able to improve this kind of verification in the sense that the verification that is necessary after an evolution is in fact minimal. So this means that in fact this can also be performed automatically by a software developer without having needing to have a security expert at hand, because this is basically now supported by this extended software development approach and the supporting tool support, which also supports evolution now. But I'm afraid I have to basically skip the details here now. Can only shortly mention, on the basis of this formal foundation, which I introduced earlier today, we now also considered questions such as, in fact, under which conditions security is or is not preserved by evolution. So these are similar results to those for refinement and modularity, which I mentioned earlier, but they are in fact different results, which unfortunately I cannot go into details now for time reasons. And we've done it firstly on an atomic level on the basis of this syntax, but then also on the sort of big step change level, which in fact goes into the direction of that refactoring result which I mentioned earlier today. And this is in fact the picture which we've already seen. This I've already mentioned as well. And I said there is some tool support which is now able to automatically support this kind of verification. And in fact, now it's of course still important not only to support evolution on the model level, but also to maintain the link between the model and the code during evolution, which is yet another challenge, but of course that's important because otherwise things will break as well. And we've extended this runtime verification approach with an approach which in fact supports refactoring not only on the model level but also on the code level and maintains the connection between those two levels. This is joint work not only with Andreas Bauer but also with the EU, from the EU. Basically this extends our tool architecture picture with tools which are in fact available out there, like this RET tool which support refactoring, and cruise control which support continuous integration in order to maintain the links between the model and the implementation level. And again, we've also applied that to the JSSE and the JSSE implementations. I think I've become close now. In the remaining seconds, I can only briefly skip through a couple of more applications. Probably I cannot give details here. So we have applied this approach over the last couple of years to a number of projects, sometimes in collaboration with industry. Here is an example, collaboration with a large German bank, Hypo Vereinsbank, where we use this approach to verify part of an internet bank architecture, where in fact they use SSL and make sure that this is used correctly in the architectural context. And there came up questions which I mentioned earlier, like this vertical layering of services and whether these you can add services that themselves enforce certain security properties and hope that the stack will then enforce all such properties. As I said earlier, unfortunately that doesn't work in general, but for some, well, under certain assumptions it does work, so we were able to identify some of those assumptions where it does in fact work. And yeah, here's just an overview slide with some other applications, which again, I don't have the time to go detail, but if you're interested to hear more about the details, of course, I would be happy to talk about that more in the coffee break. And just to finish off, a couple of more examples. We looked at the German Health Card, which is a large project issuing 50 million Germans with smart cards supporting the German health system, which is as crazy as it sounds, but it was very interesting to look at that. And in fact, we detected some problems there as well. Anyway, let's see how that goes in, with actually practically using that system. Then a cooperation with O2 Germany, also quite interesting. Fortunately, that system was in fact secure that we looked at. Another application at BMW, they are also fortunately we were able to show that their architecture was secure. We also did some work on trying to find out whether our approach is in fact better than the approach that is currently used in practice. Of course, it's not the case that practitioners completely ignore quality and security today. They have classical approaches to address them, and we did some work on trying to compare whether our new approach is now in some sense in fact better. Again, I don't have the time to talk about it, but if you're interested, I'm happy to point you to some papers there. And yeah, overview, of course, we're not the only people working on model-based security. By now, there are quite a few research groups working on that. I think it's quite an exciting field, and there are still lots of problems to be solved, as also was obvious in earlier discussions today. So even we were able to provide some answers in some cases to some of those questions. They are by no means answered completely now, so there's still lots of work to be done, also with respect to some of those questions which I mentioned. And on the other hand, it's pleasing to see that industry actually takes note of this kind of work. First claim to fame maybe was that model-driven security was in fact mentioned by a Gartner report a couple of years ago. This should further increase visibility in the industry and hopefully provide for some further uptake in the future. Current projects, I'm already over time, sorry. Of course, what we are doing now, we're extending this work in various application directions. Of course, cloud computing cannot be avoided today. It's in everyone's minds, and it is, of course, very security critical, but also very interesting, and we're also working on ways to try to address the challenges in that domain using our approach in various ways. Another issue is compliance related to security, but a little bit different, namely requirements which you can derive from legal regulations, and this is also something we try to support. Then of course also other notations, not only UML, but also business process modeling notations such as BPMN, and other techniques which I haven't mentioned today, like business process mining is interesting technique we're looking at the moment, and yeah, so lots of other things. And of course, I already said that there are still lots of open questions in evolution, for example, also with respect to these different foundational questions which I mentioned, and basically the things we're working on at the moment. I forgot to mention another project on security economics analysis, also in the context of model-based analysis, because in practice, you always have a trade-off between security and costs, and you always have to find the right balance, and this is something we're trying to support in another new project as well. And I think this is really the final slide, so thank you very much for your patience, and hopefully that was a bit interesting. If there are any further questions, I'm happy to answer them now or afterwards in the coffee break. Thanks a lot. guess there are no immediate further questions, so we can have coffee and discuss further.